Chapter 16. Blurs. The rest of Dodd's stay at Highgate was relatively uneventful. Boot and Buck prevailed upon Dilly and successfully obtained a day and a half of lounging around, being pampered, eating pleasant foods, playing games, talking, and relaxing in luxuriously padded chairs. Dilly and Sonny spent their time more prudently, studying books while overseeing the boys' activities. Dodd read, too, though the book he couldn't put down was of little importance to stopping the dread. He read passages from How to Be a Positive Influence on Your Grandsons. Leaving Highgate was easier than entering. When Dilly heard the first set of bells ringing, she whipped the others into order and they rode down to the passage as the tri-block field was being lifted. It couldn't have been timed better. Back at Twistyard, Uke was the first to greet the group, dressed in his usual white attire with a flowing feathered cavalier on his head. He was riding on Brown Sugar, the mare that had caused such disastrous trouble for Dodd. "I'm surprised to see you all made it back in one piece," said Uke cautiously. He was also indicating, by the expression on his face, that he wanted a full explanation of what had happened to his beloved horse, and possibly why Dodd was still breathing. Either way, he waited for someone to respond. "Yes, we're fine, thank you," said Dilly. "Oh, and I'm terribly sorry about the incident. It's good to see Brown Sugar found her way back to you. She must have stumbled through some nasty thorns before you loaned her to us, for when we made a press up Coyote Trail, the rocks set her off, nearly sending Dodd to a stony end." "That's curious," remarked Uke with a look of skepticism. He didn't continue to explain his thoughts, nor did he push anyone for further details. He patted Brown Sugar affectionately with his white-gloved hand and added, "I'm just glad you're all right." The way he rolled into a completely different subject without first getting the whole tale was bizarre, especially for Uke. "So, are you up for the big match?" he asked, glancing at Dodd. "Like a pig waiting at the trough," answered Boot, jumping in enthusiastically. Dodd didn't say anything. He stared pensively at the ground. "It'll be a great day," continued Boot, glowing with excitement. "We haven't played a full-out round of Belur's triple team for ages. This is our year to show up raw. I can feel it. And there's no better way to start off the season than to play the first game with everyone, them against us." "What do you think of it, Dilly?" asked Uke. "It'll be entertaining," she responded candidly. "I hope I can spare the time. I have so many things going on right now. Of course, I'll be playing in the regular tournaments later this year when they count." "Right, I'm sure you'll do fine," assured Uke. "I'll be watching your matches. It would be nice to see Green back in charge of the field." He swept his eyes over the group one last time as they rode the final 100 feet to the barn. Stablemen were waiting at the doors to help them off their horses. "We'll see you later, Uke," called Dilly cheerfully, turning to lead the group to their quarters. Her arms were loaded with bags of clothing, given as gifts from Commendus. Uke waved and then walked inside the barn, accompanied by Dratz, who helped care for the horses. A few moments later, he came jogging out and caught up with them. "Boot, how was your ride on Shooter?" he asked. "It couldn't have been better," said Boot, turning to heartily wrap Uke's bony shoulder. "Thanks for letting us borrow him. That's a great horse you've got. I think he's fully recovered. Therapy must have worked. He didn't falter in the slightest, even following Song up that crazy Coyote Trail." "Good, that's good. I'm glad to hear it," Uke sighed. "And to think most people would have put him down after his injury. Miz was right." Uke waved his hat in the air, nodded at Dilly and Sonny, and parted ways. He trotted back to the barn where he joined two stablemen that were waiting for him at the entrance. In the great hall, Pone approached the group and fell in line, walking between Boot and Dodd. His wavy black hair bounced slightly with each step he took. "Good to see you, bro," said Pone to Dodd, nodding. His smile engulfed his whole face. He turned to Boot and changed his tone. "Just a quick word," he said carefully, looking to the right and left. "Weird stuff has been happening around here while you were off getting your feet massaged." "I didn't have time for a foot rub," replied Boot playfully. "We were doing important business our entire stay. Hardly ate or slept." Pone rolled his eyes in disbelief. "Yeah, Golium instructed us and gave us orders," added Buck earnestly. "We were all over Highgate, not just lounging around Commendus's palace. We have knives of gratitude to prove it." When Pone continued to wear a skeptical face, Buck furiously dug through his pockets. Eventually, he produced his wonderful present and held it up. The ivory bear on his knife was dirty white from years of use, yet the gold surrounding it had been polished so many times by Buck that it glistened brightly. "Boots is nicer," he insisted excitedly. "Go ahead, Boot, show him." I don't want to make Pone jealous, said Boot, glancing quickly at Dodd, then back to Pone. Besides, I want to hear what he has to say. Tell us what happened while we were out. For starters, Rawl Hall had some middle-of-the-night intruders, said Pone, raising his eyebrows and counting with his fingers. He only got to one before he used his hand to smack Boot on the chest. They caused plenty of trouble, the kind that usually gets you into trouble. Boot smiled proudly. Dilly and Sonny both looked humorously disgusted by Boot's pleasure at being touted as a rabble-rouser. As you can imagine, continued Pone happily, Saw brought the complaint straight to Bamboo, insisting you were the instigator. Fortunately, your trip to Highgate squashed his accusations flat. Intruders, said Dilly curiously. What did they do? What startled skunks usually do, responded Pone smugly. They fouled the place up bad enough that Rawlings will be keeping their windows open for the next 100 years. It's nasty. You have to plug your nose when you walk past. And the smell's not staying in their rooms, either. Don't sit too close to them at dinner, or you'll lose your appetite in a hurry. Pone grinned roguishly at the girls as he added, Just ask Daunchy. When everyone showed by their eyes that they were dying to hear the rest, he finished. She lost the remains of her lunch on Tannis last night before she'd even made it far enough in line to see dinner. How disgusting, gasped Sonny, looking ill. I know, said Pone gleefully. And Sob's claiming their stuff was rifled through, too. Can you imagine it? The skunks must have been digging about their belongings for hours looking for food. I bet their clothes will reek for weeks. Hmm, said Dilly, throwing a side glance at Boot. She obviously suspected he had influenced the occasion due to its spiteful effects on Sob. Don't look at me, retorted Boot defensively. I was with you the whole time, miles away from the striped assailants. He turned quickly from Dilly before her eyes had time to work on him and prodded Pone for more info. Okay, he said eagerly. What else happened? A small fire in the little Ribble barn. It could have been a lot worse if Jib hadn't found it so quickly. It might have taken the whole row of barns down to the stones. We would have lost a lot of our best riding horses. A fire, too? Complained Dilly, appearing as if she felt bad that she had missed the excitement. Yep, and that's not all, said Pone with a buoyant glint in his eye. He once more paused to let the suspense build. Sir Long's going to be as mad as a hideless cow with a sunburn when he gets back. His private office and visiting quarters were invaded by someone, and his unbreakable door was broken. Zerny and Yuke have left men to secure it until he gets back. They say it appears as though nothing was taken. It serves him right, interjected Buck. After the way he taunted everyone 2 weeks ago when he had his door taken out and reinstalled with Rawl parts, claiming Bamboo didn't know a thing about security, it offended me enough to want to rip it off just to let him know that Rawl's doors are no better than what we have here in Green. Anything else? Asked Boot. The rest is smaller stuff, confessed Pone smoothly. A group of Rawlings were soiled by mud balls while on a morning jog, and a note signed lovingly Zipod was mysteriously left for Sob, informing him of his pending loss to us at Blur's. And a loose leg mishap occurred at dinner last night, causing Joke's food to end up on his lap, and nearly Sob's as well. Now that sounds like pregame fun, admitted Boot pompously. And then catching Dilly's condemning eyes, he quickly added, at least the last few items. As the group approached Green Hall, they quickly noticed the doors were shut. The smell in the air answered the question why. They were too close to Rawl Hall to be left open. Dodd, are you excited for the big game? Asked Pone, helping Boot push one of the large doors open. I guess, said Dodd hesitantly. Hearing about the match made his stomach start to churn. Boot studied Dodd's face and noticed the concern. We should practice today after dinner, he casually suggested. Go over the rules and basic techniques for all of the Greenlings that haven't played much. With full-out triple-team Belurs, we can technically include all of the Lings at the same time, and I'm sure Sob will insist every Rawling join their Kusings on the field, so we better make sure we get as many of our Greenlings as we can. Numbers are everything. Once the door was closed, blocking the putrid air, Greenlings and Kusings seeped out of the bedrooms, greeting Boot and Buck with inquiries about the upcoming event. Dilly and Sonny disappeared into their separate quarters, where a few female voices welcomed them. I did it, whispered Toose, who approached Boot quietly from the rear. So I heard, responded Boot cautiously, glancing over his shoulder to make sure Dilly wasn't eavesdropping. He, Buck, and Dodd invited Toose into their bedroom and then closed the door tightly, but only after Boot had yelled down the hall, Meet at the Blur's field after dinner for some warm-ups and strategy talk. We're taking Rawl down! Before anyone had found a comfortable spot, Boot asked Toos for the truth. You didn't have any part in the barn fire or Serlonk's door, did you? No, I didn't know anything about them. I stuck to the basics. The non-harmful kind of stuff. Mud balls at joggers, mysterious notes from fictional superheroes, an extra dose of salt at dinner, and other mild annoyances like that. Certainly nothing destructive. Good, said Boot, sighing heavily. He looked relieved to hear that he hadn't accidentally influenced anything too malicious. I like the skunk one, added Buck, chuckling as he lay on his bed. How did you manage to sneak them in? With Zerny and Jib roaming around at night, leading the Drat Patrol, you must have really worked hard. Well, it was tough, claimed Toos, smiling uncomfortably. Just for the record, Boot interjected, the skunk prank was pushing the limit, but funny nonetheless. Next time you use stinkers, maybe you could have Sob and his crowd fall prey to a spraying outside of the castle. Let them enjoy the smell while minimizing the interior damage. No kidding, said Dodd, sniffing his shirt. The strong smell in the hall had attached to his clothes. Two stared at the ground and finally confessed, I didn't do the skunk prank. Someone beat me to it. If I had done it, I'd probably smell like a skunk right now. You all know I'm not exactly a mailer. Really? Said Boot as he lay down on his bed. Toos and Buck carried on with small talk and eventually left the room for dinner. Dodd and Boot, on the other hand, withdrew from the conversation to think and then traded notes with Dilly and Sonny on their way to supper. It doesn't make sense, said Dilly, looking puzzled. Who would have started the fire, skunked Rawl Hall, and broken down Serlonk's door, all while Drat guards roamed the halls on duty? She pulled at one of her curls while she thought. It must be the works of the Dread, she concluded, or at least one of his helpers. But what's he doing it for? And why the two attacks against people from Rawl, added Boot. The Dread seems to favor them while punishing Green, and especially Soosh. Even the death threat Bamboo received was specifically aimed at people from Soosh staying at Twistyard. Don't forget about the incident Serlonk had on the way to Highgate, said Dodd, grabbing Boot's shoulder. It was more than a coincidence that he experienced a rough ride on the same day I did. Maybe the Dread has decided to play us against each other, affecting people from Rawl as well. What better way to stir up conflict than to lead conceited nobles like Serlonk and Juni to believe everyone's against them? You heard the way he spoke about Zerny and the other Drats. He naturally assumes they're the ones that poorly situated his saddle. And though it may have been Zerny, it also could have been Yuke or anyone else. We really don't know. After all, Yuke did help with saddling our horses, didn't he? Well, blurted Dilly, shaking her head. She stopped in the hall and looked at Dodd. I'm sure Yuke wouldn't have hurt his own mare. So if the same person set a trap of both horses, we can rule Yuke out. She's right, said Sonny, agreeing with Dilly. But for the love of Selusi, that mare is foremost in Yuke's heart. I remember the time he wouldn't leave the barn for a week, even to eat, when his horse was ill. And despite Shooter's full recovery, he never rides him. He's always on that mare. And to think Yuke trusted me with his favorite horse, moaned Dodd. No, interjected Dilly sorely. He trusted me, handing both horses over in the barn. You just happened to ride the mare. Anyway, said Dodd, groaning loudly. He hadn't meant to create a fuss. I'm just saying, I think the Dread is striking around us, prodding people to get angry at each other, even if what he's doing doesn't make much sense. Maybe he's trying to frame people, get them in trouble with the soldiers and Commendus. I'm even beginning to wonder about Zerny and Jib. They could be innocent after all, victims of the Dread's web. I've told you before, insisted Dilly. I can vouch for them. You didn't seem so sure the morning we returned from the night ride, contended Dodd. Remember how you acted around Jib? I would still feel better about them if I could see their bare hands. Besides, why does Zerny stutter at times and speak clearly at other times? He doesn't, said Dilly, beginning to walk toward dinner. The others followed. He's had difficulty from birth. If you thought you heard him speak clearly, you must be mistaking Jib for Zerny. Before Dodd could respond to Dilly's accusations, Sonny broke into the middle of the conversation with her own question. Have you had any more of those impressions, Dodd? Not since the one I had right before we left for Highgate. Which reminds me, we should break into Sword Tower tonight. If the Dread is causing the problems we've had around here, he's eventually going to do what I've seen. And it's dark. People are going to die. We need to stop him. Sword Tower tonight, moaned Dilly. It's on your list, argued Boot. And you've broken in before. Why not tonight? Ugh, Dilly complained. She glanced at Boot and then looked at the floor before explaining. Dodd hasn't gotten his keys back yet. What does that have to do with Sword Tower? Asked Boot, raising an eyebrow. One of his keys is to the safety vault building next door to Sword Tower, and another one is to a box inside, or at least I think so. With a key to the front of the safety vault building, the guards stationed there will let us enter. And once we're in, I know of a fire escape tunnel that leads to Sword Tower's inner courtyard. Soldiers don't guard it. From there, we can easily pry a garden window open, and just like that, we're free to roam Sword Tower. "That's genius, Dilly," exclaimed Sonny admiringly. She had known her older sister was clever enough to make it past the guards to acquire swords for her necessary collection, just in case the Kusings needed to take arms quickly, and they were hers by right of inheritance anyway. However, this was the first time Dilly had revealed her system. "Then how did you get a key before?" asked Boot. "Papa lent it to me. He actually lent me both keys. One is for the front door, and the other unlocks a special box, though I've never seen it. I don't even know which one of the thousands of boxes it is. I only wanted a back entrance to Sword Tower." "Why didn't you tell me before?" gasped Dodd. He thought of how miserable it was that he had lost the keys necessary for getting into a safety box, along with the key to Pap's house. "I wasn't sure if they were the right keys," answered Dilly, "and with Boot around, I didn't want to be wrong. I figured we would try them out when we got a chance. We just need to go look for them, and if they're gone, well, let's hope they're not." "That means we'll need to break into Yuke's quarters and climb up the wall from his balcony," said Boot eagerly. "Shh," whispered Sonny, reminding the group that they were entering a busier area. The closer they got to the Great Hall, the more traffic buzzed around them, Drat soldiers included. "Maybe we could arrange a meeting with Yuke," said Dodd, not particularly wanting to chance getting caught. "If we all went together, a few of us could slip out onto his patio while he's fetching something from another room, and then the rest of us could make excuses for why the others had to leave." "That's a great idea," agreed Sonny. She, too, didn't like the thought of doing anything that could be misconstrued as an evil act against the Greats, especially after someone had already broken down Sir Lonk's door, leaving them to be blamed if they were seen wiggling into Yuke's private rooms uninvited. "I'll line it up," said Dilly, stepping prominently into the lead position of the conversation. "It may not be for tonight, but I'll get him to see us as soon as he can to discuss his historic strategies. Once he starts talking about the past, it'll be easy for me and Sonny to distract his attention long enough to buy you boys plenty of time on his patio." As the group entered the Great Hall, Dodd shivered disconcertingly. Jib was walking past in the opposite direction, explaining to Zerny that he had personally searched Sir Lunk's quarters without finding anything noteworthy, and that guards held the entrance, awaiting a new door. Dodd felt chilled for a number of reasons. He had just seen Zerny and Jib sporting their white-gloved hands, their swords, and their shiny golden badges. After they passed, Dilly remarked that she felt safer seeing soldiers walking the halls with weapons. However, it made her terribly jealous. "Safer?" hissed Dodd. "Are you crazy? Didn't you hear what Jib said? He's the one that broke down Sir Long's door to search the quarters. There's no stopping them from their witch hunt." "That's not what he said," argued Dilly. "He said he personally searched Sir Lonk's quarters without finding anything of concern. I'm sure he was in charge of overseeing the break-in investigation, and as part of his job, he checked for any signs of rummaging. After all, he is one of the head security officers. Besides, he just said he put soldiers there to guard the door. If he bashed it down to have a look inside, do you really think he would stick around and call the soldiers up to notice his handiwork?" Dilly made a good point, but it didn't change Dodd's uneasy feeling about the circumstance. During dinner, the hot topic at each table was the pending Belurse game. Everyone was either a player or an interested fan, and notwithstanding the snobbery of Rall Kusings and Rawlings toward everyone else, most people at Twistyard were expecting Rall Hall to rule the field. Regardless, Boot and Buck bragged up enough confidence to almost convince a few tables that Green Hall had a fighting chance. At the same time, Sob and his close buddies, Joke and Quit, reveled in their past wins, boasting gleefully to their peers from Rawl. They even managed to lead a sizable group in a chant against Boot. The presentation was choppy at best, as each tormentor strained to read the gibberish penned by Quit. "We don't know why Boot thinks he's hot. His style needs class. He's a hopeless pot. And all he brags to us, we know he's really not. So a beggar can't be a chooser. Go home like Bowie, you loser." One girl, a Rall Kusing, shamelessly trying to impress Sob, stood on his table during the chant and made all sorts of flirtatious hand signs that were supposed to fit the words. Upon finishing, She smirked wickedly at Boot, pushing her long black hair out of her face, revealing her shiny red lips, and said, "When you get home, tell your nutty brother I can't ride him anymore." She hopped down coyly, readjusted her skirt, and walked up behind Sob before adding, "Long distances are one thing, but when he can't even remember my name, it's too much." The Rawlings laughed and oohed while twitting their fingers in Boot's direction. He took offense, yet stayed in control. Had they only made fun of him, he probably would have laughed it off. However, joking about his younger brother's serious condition was despicable. It infuriated him. He had to speak up. "Clever," said Boot coldly to the crowd from Rawl. "Though I must warn you all, if you keep listening to Sob, you're likely to continue stinking. Those poor little skunks bumping into the likes of a real stench in the night. Sob." "Oh, and Alexa, if you think Bowie ever noticed you, you're the one with the horrible memory." Boot turned away and walked slowly across the room and out into the courtyard. He partially hoped Sob would follow him, but he knew the best way to show him up would be at the Blurs game. Dilly went nuts, chattering with the other girls about how trashy Alexa and her clique were. It made her blood boil. She insisted that Bowie would never have paid any degree of attention to the likes of Eluxa or her pathetic friends from Rawl, and that the only truth was her heartless reference to poor Bowie's injury, which only proved all the more how classless and tasteless she was. It irritated Dilly so bad that when Pwn teasingly noted how smoking hot she was, Dilly dumped her entire cup of milk down the front of his shirt. "You should have expected that, bro," said Dodd, smiling at Pwn, watching him attempt to wring the milk out. "You just don't go there and expect to come back alive. Catfights are wicked." Dodd hopped out of his seat and went to fetch another cup for Dilly. After the commotion died down, Greenlings and Green Coosings finished their dinners and headed for the field. Dilly and Sonny kept Dodd company as he nibbled. He wasn't looking forward to practicing Blurs. To him, it was like knowing he had to perform in a piano recital without having a song to play. Before they finally left to meet with the others, Tonus walked past Dilly and then tripped, clumsily dropping his tray on the floor by Dilly's feet. "Tell Boot I'm sorry about the way they acted," whispered Tonus nervously. "They're stupid idiots today. We all understand about Bowie." Tonus quickly picked up his tray and walked away, playing the part of an awkward-footed fool. "There goes one person from Rawl I can actually tolerate," said Dilly. "He's from Rawl?" gasped Dodd in surprise, not recognizing him. "Yes, he's one of the newest Rawl Coosings. It's amazing how someone like that can survive living with the rest of them." She looked over at the other members of Rawl Hall, who were still lingering at their tables. They were boisterously laughing in unison at Sob's jokes, like the bleating of a herd of sheep, despite the fact that most of the things he said weren't very witty. The Blurs Field was located on the outer edge of the complex, beyond the grassy courtyard, on the other side of the half-circle wall of trees and buildings. It was similar in shape to a rectangular football field, only twice as large and completely surrounded by a 25-foot retaining wall, for the entire court was below ground. Entrance to the field was down one of two rope ladders, positioned at the ends. Outside the retaining wall, a stadium-like hill of grass rose up 200 feet, with no trees, enclosing the playing field in the middle. Perfect seating for spectators. On the field there were 60 posts that resembled mini telephone poles, 30 per side, each 13 feet tall. They were placed symmetrically with a dense concentration of them at the two opposite ends of the court and a scattering of them in the open space between. Their purpose was to hold leather bots, hollow 18-inch cones with team rags protruding out of the tops. A 3-foot stone wall split the playing field down the middle, and in the very center of the wall was a 30-foot post situated to hold the final bot. Seeing this setup unlocked memories of the game in Dodd's mind. Blurs was a combination of dodgeball, capture the flag, mock war, and baseball. Traditionally, there were 18 players per team. The full-out triple-team Blurs was a twist-yard invention, allowing the Coosings and their respective Lings to play together on the same team, up to 15 Coosings and 50 Lings if everyone participated. Players were allotted a shield, swat, jung, head guard, and also 8 globes. The shield was lightweight and perfectly circular, about 2 feet in diameter. The swat resembled a mixture of a bat and a paddle. The jung was a leather bag used to carry up to 12 globes. It attached to the waist and one leg with leather straps, bracing it tightly against the body. The head guard was a thick hide helmet with metal wires crossing in front of the eyes, nose, and mouth, barely close enough to shield against a globe, and with woven padding on the inside that trailed below the helmet, draping down far enough to completely cover the neck. The globes were slightly smaller than baseballs, made of leather wrapped and sewn around dried hoose fruits after being dipped in a sticky bean glue mixture. Regulation play called for one head judge to stand toward the middle, outside of the field, up on top of the retaining wall. It was his job to start the match, oversee fair play, make final decisions, and ultimately declare a winner. To aid the judge, four referees roamed the field, keeping a close watch on players. The object of Blurs was very simple. Knock all 30 of the opposing team's bots down, and then close by dislodging the neutral winning bot, or eliminate all of the other team's players. Dodd, Dilly, and Sonny made their way down a rope ladder, entering the field just in time to catch Boots' explanation of the game. "Remember the rules. Judges are quick to enforce them, and you can bet tomorrow will be no exception. Stay clear of the players from the other team. If you touch them, or even if you only bump them with your shield or swat, you're both out. Keep that in mind. No contact." "But what if it's an accident?" asked a younger greenling named Kurt, who was seated on the grass close to the front of the mob. He looked 12 and terrified. His spiky brown hair drooped with concern while he clicked his fingernails. "Doesn't matter. A touch is a touch. And if you do make contact, even if it's an accident, speak up quickly and exit the field before we're penalized another player for breaking the rules." "And that goes for a globe hit, too," added Buck, who was standing next to Boot, beaming with a look of sheer excitement. "If you're hit, fess up quickly and exit the field up our ladder. That's how you can help our team the best at that point. Trying to fudge isn't honorable, and they'll catch you for sure. The globe will leave a welt for a short while, and then it's a mandatory one-man penalty when they call you off the field as a cheat. You can bet that whomever we choose to exit with you will be flustered for weeks, as will the whole team if we lose on your account." "Do the globes hurt?" asked Donshi, fidgeting nervously with her light brown curls. She was sitting next to Kurt. Together, they formed a mini coalition of newbies. "How many of you haven't played before?" bellowed Boot, making sure everyone could hear him. His eyes panned the group. Six hands shot up, all sitting at the front with Donshi. They were the youngest greenlings in the bunch, so it was no surprise that they hadn't played. Dodd almost raised his hand, too. However, he felt self-conscious wedged between Dilly and Sonny, two expert players. Besides, he rationalized, he did have memories of the game. They flooded his mind when he saw the field, and they were so vivid that he almost felt like a seasoned player. Where a knot had filled his gut during dinner, a bit of excitement was building. Something inside him wanted to play, and the newfound memories gave him grounds to hope he would perform acceptably. "Would you do better without us?" asked Donshi. No, of course not. We're a team, and that's the way it's going to be," said Boot convincingly. "Everyone is important. This game is all about sticking together. If you're good at throwing, focus on getting within range of a couple of bots before the other team gets you. And don't worry about being hit by a globe. It may sting for a few minutes if the globe is fresh off a swat, but that fades faster than the sting of defeat." Kurt and Donshi didn't appear convinced. Pain did sound worse to them than losing. However, disappointing Boot and Buck was clearly worse than that, so they continued to listen. Boot reviewed the rules, emphasizing key things to remember, and then grilled the newcomers on their retention. Dodd listened intently and took confidence from hearing Boot explain what he already knew from memory. The globes were considered live when launched from an opponent and continued to be live until they hit the ground. If a live globe made contact with the player anywhere on his body, including his helmet, the player would be out of the game and would need to leave immediately, and couldn't by regulation have further influence on the game, including vocally giving advice or commands to other teammates. If a globe was launched from one player to another player on the same team, it would not be considered live, as one team member handing off a globe to another team member. If a live globe was deflected by a shield or swat, it instantly became live against the opposite team and no longer live for the deflecting team, as in the case when a live globe is hit with a swat back to its originator or its originator's teammate. Players started the game with 8 globes in their jung and could attain additional globes from the bases of the posts, where piles of 10 lay at the beginning of the game. All of the globes were fair ammunition for both sides. Globes could be thrown, kicked, or hit toward opposing people in an attempt to reduce their forces. The same globes were to be used in knocking the opposite team's bots down. In order to win, a team needed to knock down all 30 opposing bots, plus the winning bot, or eliminate all of the players on the challenging team. In the event of an injury, a freeze could be called, though the injured person would be escorted off the field by referees, even if the injury proved to be minor, while the other players remained stationary, ready to resume play as soon as the judge declared continue. Buck repeatedly interrupted Boot, adding strategic elements to the game. Let's assign some defenders to stay in the back on home ground and send attackers in groups to knock down opposing bots. Keep less skilled players protected, so we can use them to gather globes for the seasoned players. Position us on opposite sides to split the enemy's forces and provide leadership. As Buck and Boot planned for the following day's game, Dilly leaned over and whispered her discontent to Dot and Sonny. Here it comes. Boot's going to assign us to back defense, and then blame us as the final defenders if Saab finishes us off tomorrow. I thought you and Sonny were going to be rooting through Rawl Hall unnoticed, responded Dodd. Wasn't that the original purpose of this match? It was, said Dilly, rolling her eyes. But did you see how many drats are stinking up their clothes sitting guard at the entrance to Rawl Hall? It's pointless. Besides, if their quarters were targeted by the Dread with skunks, it doesn't seem likely that they are connected in a friendly relationship. Dilly and Sonny shouted, Boot. We'll be depending on the two of you to cover back defense tomorrow. You'll be joining us, won't you? Yes, said Sonny with a smile, starting to laugh at how predictable Boot was. And Dodd, he continued, what position do you usually play? Take your pick and make it stick. Boot spoke with the tone of a general, organizing real forces for a pending battle. It was amusing to see how serious Boot and Buck took the game. After all, it was only a game. I stuttered Dodd. I like to see where I'm needed the most, and then fill in. Make sure we win. Well said, praised Buck, smiling uncontrollably, fueled by his contagious enthusiasm. See, Buck shouted to the group. With Dodd on our side, we'll break their pride. With Dodd on our side, we'll break their pride. With Dodd on our side, we'll break their pride. By the third time Buck chanted the rhyme, all of the others chanted with him. It was a battle cry of sorts. Dodd felt slightly discomforted, for he would have rather gone unnoticed on the field unless he proved worthy of the attention. Game day came quickly. With the afternoon return of Strat, an early evening time was set. Crowds of people took their seats surrounding the pit, eager to watch the Halls battle it out. Many of the spectators even brought their dinners with them, fearing that they wouldn't get a good spot if they first ate in the Great Hall. With both teams suited up, tradition had them nod heads in line, face to face, before climbing down their respective ladders. It was a show and promise of fair play during the game. As Dodd crossed paths with Saab, a foot reached out and helped Dodd to the ground, and unfortunately, on his way, he knocked Dilly and Sonny over with him. They landed in a heap, awkwardly encroaching into Rawl Hall's line. Eluxa pulled her shoe out from under Sonny's chin and casually wiped it across Sonny's sprawling hair, all the while giggling obnoxiously with two beanpole-thin girls in front of her. They fully enjoyed the predicament. I see you're still having trouble walking, mocked Saab, pointing a condemning finger at Dodd's legs.
For your sake, I hope you can run, boy, responded Dodd in his manliest voice. He hadn't had time to think, so the line flowed from a movie he had watched many times with his brothers.
Saab chuckled and walked on, completely unaffected by Dodd's warning. Despite the traditional nod, most of the Rawlings and Rawl Cousings suggested by the look in their eyes and their general demeanor that the nod was a formality and it meant very little with regard to integrity of play. On the field, spirits were high. The smell of damp grass floated around the shady battlefield, carried on an evening breeze. Everyone waited anxiously for the purple cloth to indicate the start of the game, and no sooner had it waved than a barrage of globes filled the air. Within a minute, six greenlings and two green Cousings had been struck and were on their way up the ladder. Donshi stopped every few rungs to rub her shoulder, making it clear she had felt the blow that sent her out, and Kurt followed close on her heels, looking relieved to be done. Boot led a right flank attack with 10 mates, waving his swat in the air as he prodded them to charge. Together, they breached the center wall like a band of angry chimpanzees. It was less thought out and more adrenaline, pushing hard to claim vengeance for their quick losses. However, in their ambition to be the first group to cross into enemy territory, they clumsily ventured too deep, lost three players from side snipers, and were forced to retreat. Meanwhile, Buck played a safer game. He kept a steady stream of globes flowing from his troops, who had some success. They knocked down 7 Rawl bots and sent 5 Rawlings packing. Dilly paced in the backfield. She was agitated that she wasn't storming the front, especially after the way Luxa had just treated her sister. Sonny, on the other hand, was content to watch, leaning against a post. "We'll get our chance, Dilly," she said patiently. "We need to save these globes and our energy. You know what's coming." Dodd climbed halfway up the pole Sonny was leaning against, and using a protruding knot hole, perched himself in a position to call the plays of the field for Dilly and others on back patrol. They were all getting ready to attack or defend, depending on orders from Boot. "It looks like Saab is holding the middle with 12, and Joke has our left, a third of the way back, with about 15. Quid is on our right, farther back than Joke. He seems to be doing something. He's got a lot of people. Now they're moving forward. Now backward. It's like he can't make up his mind." "Oh, I see. He misunderstood orders from Saab." "How is Buck doing?" asked Sonny. "He's still knocking globes forward, but his pace has slowed down. They must be getting low. They need to restock." "Maybe a few of us can move up and help Boot and Buck," suggested Dilly, gripping her SWAT, white-knuckled with anticipation. "Hold on," said Sonny, chuckling at her sister's exuberance. "Let's wait for the signal. Unless Boot's down, he's our leader, then Buck, then you." "Ugh," groaned Dilly, wild-eyed with frustration. "By the time I get to lead the game, we're always hopelessly behind." Dilly's lament gave Dodd an idea. He hopped down from the pole and smiled at Dilly and Sonny. "Tell me, who leads Rawl when Saab goes out?" Both girls looked at each other and thought for a few moments. Their answers were almost in unison. "I don't know. I don't remember ever seeing Saab go out," said Sonny matter-of-factly. "When we attack with a group, he always retreats and hides," added Dilly, smirking. "He's a coward." "Yes," said Dodd, his enthusiasm mounting. "But he's the coward that's leading their every move. Who knows what the game will be like when he's gone?" Without saying anything more, Dodd ran for the front line. His heart was pounding rapidly. He hadn't been very good at baseball, yet it wasn't because he couldn't run. When he neared the stone wall, he stopped for a minute behind a pole to take off his jung. It was slowing him down. He threw his jung filled with globes toward Buck and yelled, "Launch them in Saab's direction. I'm going in." The stone wall was easy to hop, though once on the other side, Dodd realized how determined Rawl was to defend their soil. Every Rawling and Rawl coosing within throwing or hitting range of Dodd proceeded to volley their globes at him. It was a hailstorm. Thoughts of retreat crept into his mind. Nevertheless, a stronger image came bursting to the forefront, and like the rising of the sun in the morning, it melted away the dimly lit stars of doubt. He could see Strat standing alone by the fire, batting and blocking arrows, and with a rush of confidence, Dodd knew he could do it too. When the globes came showering down, rather than running from them, Dodd stood in the open and received them. All of the attackers were far enough away that any given globe could be detected and deflected by focusing on the nearest one first, and then the next, and then the next, and then the one after that. Every moment was intense. To the right, now to the left, an upward block with shield, a downward block with SWAT, center block, quick step to the side, lower leg block, step hop left, quick high block left, low center block, step hop step. During the course of 4 minutes, which felt to Dodd like an eternity, over 150 globes were hurled without any of them hitting him. It was unprecedented. The pile of globes at Dodd's feet littered the ground. Cheers roared from behind him. Boot's voice distinctly chanted, "Dodd, Dodd, Dodd," until the crowd in the stands began to follow suit. "Dodd, Dodd, Dodd!" Saab shook his hands and pointed toward Dodd in frustration and anger, while Quit and Joke appeared to be leading their forces and slowing down the number of globes they were using as their supply began to run low. 3 more minutes passed, and another 80 globes were added to the heaps on the ground at Dodd's feet, the majority of which came from Saab and his pals in the middle. None of them had connected. The crowd, who had become so involved that most of them had risen to their feet, continued to chant on and off, "Dodd, Dodd, Dodd," as well as clever variations such as, "Saab can't hit, Dodd won't quit," and "Block, Dodd, block, Saab's just talk." Finally, the moment came. Saab lost his temper and actually pushed one of his own teammates to the ground, apparently for holding back a spare globe. Within a few minutes, the middle field forces were completely out of ammunition. They began to scamper backward, retreating in search of more globes to hurl. That was Dodd's cue. The race was on. After raising his SWAT high in the air and yelling attack, Dodd ran straight for Saab. In the commotion, and while turning around to give orders to his troops who were retreating, Saab didn't notice Dodd's approach until he was within 20 feet. And when he did, he looked like a scared schoolboy running from the class bully, despite the obvious reality that Saab was much bigger than Dodd. It was a moment Dodd would cherish for a long time, and from the sounds of the crowd, Dodd wasn't the only one who was enjoying Saab's distress. To increase speed and prepare for his attack, Dodd dropped his shield and SWAT, and in the true spirit of an American boy, he gave Saab a lesson in another sport, football. The tackle was perfect. Clumps of grass and dirt hung from Saab's mangled face guard as Dodd helped him to his feet. "I thought I told you to run, boy," said Dodd, grinning with his whole face. "Apparently, my legs work just fine." Saab limped as he took a step. "You've lost your freshy mind, fool," he growled bitterly. His eyes narrowed to slits in anger as he straightened up, rubbing his back. "Now we're both out of the game." "I know," said Dodd proudly. "It's all going as planned." Butenbach quickly followed behind Dodd, securing the piles of globes. They proceeded to massacre the leaderless troops of Rawlings and Rawlkusings with ease, and Dilly even got her chance to Peggy Luxa right in the posterior as she fled. It was a wonderful sight for Dodd to view while climbing the rope ladder, not in defeat, but in strategic victory.